This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Let us check whether the various indications of the coming of the Mashiach are occurring or not. The Gemara tells us how to know whether we're living in the Mashiach times or not. Instead of always guessing, let's check it out. Let's see what the list is and see how many of them already apply. Gemara says at the end of Sotah, Be'ikvois Mashicho, in the time immediately preceding the coming of the Mashiach, a few things will exist. The first one is chutzpah yasko. There will be an enormous amount of chutzpah in the world. Okay? Score one. And then there's no recounting for this one. We get it right the first time. Ve'yoker yamir, and inflation will distort the economy. Hagefen titen pirio v'hayayin b'yoker. There will be an abundance of vines, but wine will be expensive. Interesting, there's no shortage of vines, and yet look how expensive a good bottle of wine is. Umalchus tehapech l'minus. Governments will become secular. Ve'en techochos, there will not be the ability to rebuke, because whoever rebukes will be accused of being guilty of the thing they're rebuking somebody else of. Beis vaad yiyeh liznus, college campuses will become seats of prostitution. V'hagalil yecharev, the Galil will be destroyed, whatever that means. V'hagavlon yoshum, and the Gavlon is another area of Israel, will be desolate. Seems to be that it's the Gavlon seems to be the area near the Kinneret, possibly the Golan. V'anshei ha-gavul yesevavu me'il le'ir v'lo yechoneinu. People from the Gavul will go around from city to city, and they will not be begging, and they will not be given anything. Difficult to know what that means. V'chochmos sofrim tisrach. And the true wisdom of wise people will be cheap, will be despised. Ve'yorei chet yimosu, and true fearers of sin will be despised, will be mocked. Ve'ho emes tehe ne'ederes, and the truth will disappear, is the way it's simply translated. And some translated, some Rishonim explain that the Gemara in fact says, I think, that the ha'emes ne'ederes means that the emes will be made into adorim adorim. That means you will find truth not in large multitudes, but you will find truth in small groups of people here and there. They'll be made into little grouplets of people, and that's where you'll find the truth. Na'orim p'nei zekeinim yalbinu. Young boys will embarrass their elders. Zekeinim yamdu mipnei ketanim. Experienced people will stand up in the presence of young people. Ben Manuva, one can see that happening in the late dot-com economy. Ben Manuva Manavel Av, a son will despise a father. Bas Kamo Be'imo, a daughter will rise up against her mother. Kala Be'chamoso, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Oyeve ish anshe besoy, a man's enemies will be his own family. Pnei hador ki pnei hakelev, the leadership of the generation will be like the leadership of the dog, which the Chofetz Chaim explains that if you see a man walking with a dog, you'll always see the dog in front of the man. It looks as if the man is following the dog until they come to a corner. Then the dog stops, looks back, sees where the man's gone, and then he runs back to get in front of the man again. That's how the leadership will be. They'll always be out in front, looking over their shoulders to read the polls, and when they see the polls have changed, they run back and they do what the population wants them to do, and they run up front again and say, look what we're doing. That's how leadership will be. Habein enom misbayesh me'oviv. A son will not be ashamed in front of his father. And what will we have to rely on in such a time? Avinu b'shamayim, Shem HaShemayim. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam will be the only reliable, trustworthy feature of our lives will be God Himself. That's the time immediately prior to the coming of Mashiach. It looks pretty familiar. It sounds pretty familiar. The question that I want to put to you is, how is it possible that out of that enormous destruction and degeneracy will emerge the Messianic period? Surely there should be a build-up to the Messianic period. How can there be such a deterioration until all the values of the Torah have been completely undermined and reversed, and then Mashiach comes? Where does he come from? In what way is the world prepared for that? The next question. Medrash says about the creation of man, he's created from earth, as we'll learn later on. The Medrash says, Min ha'adom, he was created from earth. Rabbi Berechia and Rabbi Chelba b'shem Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman omru. Rabbi Berechia and Rabbi Chelba said in the name of Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman, Mimokoim kaparoso in nivro. Man was created from the very place of his atonement. Because we're told, where did that earth come from that man, that God created Adam, with which God created Adam? He took that from the very place where the altar was later to be built. We're told to build a Mizbeach Adomah, we have to build our altar out of Adomah, out of that same material from which man was built. Out of that earth. And the very place of that earth is the in Yerushalayim itself, where the altar will be built, the point of atonement, the place of atonement. From that place, Mimokum Kaparoso Nivro, man is created from the point of his own atonement. The phrasing of the Medrash is wrong. It should say Mimokum Brioso Miskate. Man will be atoned from the place from which he was created, which came first, the atonement or the creation. So why does the Medrash say man is created from the place of his atonement? It should be man will be atoned from the very place from which he was created. There seems to be a reverse sequence in that Medrash. To deal with those questions, which don't seem to appear to be connected, but they are, we look at the beginning of the creation of man in the sixth day. First, God creates the animals, which I'm not going to get into. The first part of the sixth day, he creates the wild animals. He's already created birds and fish. On the sixth day, he creates all the animals, the land-based animals, not the amphibians, not the sea creatures, not the flying creatures. All the land-based animals are created on the sixth day. And Adam. Interestingly also, that the creation of man which is in verse 26. By Yomer Elokim, and Hashem said, Nase Odom betzalmenu kidmusenu, let us make man in our image, in our form, in our image, v'yirdu bidgas hayom, v'oif hashumayim, v'abahimo, v'chol chayos hasode, v'chol chayos haoretz, v'chol haoretz, v'chol haremes haremes al haoretz, and let them rule over. Let man rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and the animals, and all of the land, and everything that crawls on it. On that, interestingly enough, the Spurnu says that the way to read this is by Yomer Elokim, Nase Odom, says the Spurnu, Min mimine nefesh chayo sheyotzarti sheshmoy Odom. One of the species that I have already created in the beginning of the sixth day, which is called Adam, Naaseyu b'tzalmenu, let us now make it in our form. You hear what the Sipurna is saying? That man was created together with the animals in the beginning of the sixth day. When it says that God created the animals, that's when man was created, the bodily form of man. And at this point he says, let us take that being, one of the animals that we created, and let us form him into something that is in our image. So that there was a physical transformation from an animal origin to ourselves, there is no question about. That our physical bodies had some origins in the animal world, you don't have to be a big maven to see the similarities and to realize that our physical, that our anatomy is not that different from the animals. And that we're the same kind of species from a purely anatomical point of view. That's easy, that's clear. Spooner said it long before Darwin, the Ramban said it long before Darwin, the Midrashim that make it clear. There's no question about that. But God does something with all of that. God takes that form and remakes him, transforms him into something different. What is all that about? What's also interesting is that in all the other creations, up until this point, whenever something was created, God says, let there be, and there was. That's how the creation is. Let there be this, and there was. Let there be this, and there was. That's the end of it. In the case of Adam, there are a lot more verbs. God says, na'aseh Adam, let us make man. He doesn't say, let there be man. Let us make man, and he will rule over the earth. And then he says, Vayivro Elohim, and God created. This is the third time the word created comes. First time we said was in the beginning, when the whole of all the material and all the energy of the world was created. The second one was when life was created, as we learned last week on the fifth day. And the third time is when man is created. Each of those are exponential improvements. They are not linear improvements on the creation that have evolved completely from what went before. They have partially evolved. And there's the imposition of a new layer that doesn't come from anywhere. A new layer that is created for the first time then. So when God created the Taninim, the Levioson, as we learned last week, when God created animal life last week, whatever it was that God added last week, the question of male and female, the way we interpreted that God created sexuality on the fifth day, the word brio is there. He created it. That was something God created. And here too, although there's some form of evolution taking place, some kind of element of what was to become the human being had its origins in the animal world, there is a bria that now takes place, there's a new creation that takes place. So we've got God says, let us make, and now he says, and he created. And later on it uses the word vayitzer, he formed. There's a lot more process in the creation of man than in the creation of any other part of the universe. But what's striking is God's use of the plural. Hashem says, Na'aseh Adam betzalmenu kidmusenu, let us make man. Who's he talking to? Let us make man. How many people make men? And when Moshe was writing that down, he got a little concerned. And God was dictating the Torah to Moshe. When Moshe was busy writing the Torah, he was writing down first day's creation, second day, he was writing it along. When he came to this verse, as it says, let us make man in our form and in our image. He stopped and he said to God, this is a terrible thing you're writing. This isn't in your interests, God, because this would give proof to the biblical critics that there's more than one God. This would give proof to the agnostics to say that there's more than one God. Who are you talking to? It's amazing that you would write it this way. God says to him, so, write it. And whoever wants to make a mistake is welcome to make a mistake. I don't have to distort the truth in order to avoid the possibility of somebody making a mistake. So what is the truth? Who was God talking to? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe. God said, Moshe, HaAdam HaZeh Shebarasi, this man that I've created, Lo Gedolim Uktanim Ani Ma'amid Mimenu, he's going to have children who are great, and he's going to have children who are pretty ordinary. If he comes into a situation where he might be expected to consult with more junior people than himself, and he might say, why should I do that? People will be able to say to him, learn from your creator. Shiloh Boreis HaElyonim V'Satachtonim, Shehu Boreis HaElyonim V'Satachtonim, created the upper worlds and the lower worlds. He created the angels. Kivan Shebo Libreis HaSa'odom, when he created man, Nimlach B'Malochi HaShoreis, he discussed it, he consulted with his angels, although his angels were his own creation. What was the purpose of that consultation? What would have happened had they said, no, we don't think it's a good idea, which in fact they did say, after he was consulting with him? What was his purpose in so doing it? Says Rashi, nevertheless, the Torah teaches us derech eretz and modesty. That the older, the strong, the greater one should discuss and ask the permission of the younger one. That he should actually consult with people who are junior to oneself. The process of consultation is a necessary process. And that's really interesting, because if we would say it's just a matter of courtesy, then it's interesting that man isn't even created yet. God's teaching courtesy before man is created. Not only is man God teaching courtesy before man is created, but God creates man with a statement of courtesy. The words that create man are Naaseh Odom B'Tzamenu. Those are the very words that give the force to man's creation. That means the Spirit of God from which we are created is God's Midas HaDerech Eretz, God's characteristic of derech eretz, of courtesy, of kindness, of sensitivity, of thoughtfulness. That's what we're created from more than anything else. What's the meaning of that thoughtfulness? What's the point of thoughtfulness that has no meaning? To consult with somebody that you're not going to listen to in any case, what's the point of that? And they know you're not going to listen to him, and you know you're not going to listen to them. What's the whole circus? Why go through all that? What is the meaning of that courtesy? Is there a role for that kind of courtesy? We have to say it's more than courtesy. There wouldn't be a role for something that is meaningless and is just form and has no real meaning whatever. There must be something more in the process of consulting with people whose views you will not necessarily accept, or you might definitely not accept. So what is the purpose? What is the point of that kind of process? Let's add that onto the questions and we'll now begin to understand it. What does it mean, B'tzalmenu Kidmusenu? Let us make man in our image. So I might have thought that means in the image of God and his angels. So he would have made us similar to the world of the angels. B'tzalmenu Kidmusenu, not only in God's image, but in the image of the angels. The Gemara, the Medrash, by teaching us that God's saying B'tzalmenu, God's using the plural, is only an act of courtesy, means that there is no intention for him to make us in their image. He only did that in order to bring them into the process of the creation. But when God said, what he really meant was, let me make man in my image. He doesn't say that. He says, let us make man in our image in order to be more inclusive. But God's intention is, let me make man in my image. That's what he means by it. In other words, clearly the Medrash is giving us to understand that we are not made in the image of angels. Because if we were made in the image of angels, we wouldn't be able to learn the derech eretz. This wouldn't be courtesy. Then this would be reality. God would have said, let us make man in our image. If it meant that literally, you couldn't learn the derech eretz from there. God was then stating fact. By the fact, the Medrash says, this is not fact. This is only derech eretz. That means that God created us like himself and not like the angels. So we have to understand, what is there about the angels that is different from God, and that difference is the essence of our creation. That's what we have to understand. Otherwise it's too big a concept. We're created in God's image. What aspect of God's image? What is there about God that is reflected in ourselves? And it has to be something that God has and the angels don't have. What is it? Midrash says, another Midrash, Omer Rabbi Avu, Rabbi Avu learned, Mikan Shakudush Boruchu Hayo Boire Olomos Umacharivo. Boire Olomos Umacharivo. Here we see that God created worlds, He created universes and destroyed them, and created new universes and destroyed them, and over again. Ad Sheboro Es Eilu, until He created this universe. Omar, Dein Hanayon Li, Yasin Loi Hanayon Li. He said, these I enjoy, the previous ones I didn't enjoy. They weren't right, so I destroyed them. And where does it learn from? Omar Rabbi Pinchas Tamei de Rabbi Avo. Where does this come from? From a verse a little bit further on in today's section. And God saw everything that He had created, and it was exceedingly good. What does it mean, everything that He has created? Each day it says, and God saw what He had created. Why on the sixth day does it say God saw everything that He created? This I'm enjoying, that I'm not enjoying. So He looked at everything I've created, and against the backdrop of the universes He destroyed, He looked at this, and it was tov mo. This was really good. This He could see was great. But before that, there were worlds that He destroyed that He wasn't satisfied with. That's what the Midrash says. That's a Kabbalistic concept, very difficult for us to understand. But there's an amazing, very difficult piece of Reb Notto Hirsch Finkel who explains that this is what is essentially the difference between God and angel. That God doesn't only create worlds, God destroys too. And that the capacity to build the new out of the ashes of the old is something uniquely godly. To create something that isn't perfect, destroy it, and from that very destruction, build something more perfect than the old, that's godly. The angels can't do that, the angels don't do that. Not only is that godly, says Reb Notto Hirsch, but that is also the process. He says, Zehu derech chochmo. This is the process of intellect. This is the process of thinking. How do you think? You start with an assumption, and unless you destroy that assumption, you won't get any further. That's as far as you'll go. And most people get stuck exactly there. The first thing they hear, that's where they get stuck. That becomes the last thing they hear. And then somebody tells them something else, and then they stick on that. But they don't know how to go through the process of destroying one idea in order to build the next. That the concept that the next idea, that new ideas are built out of the destruction of the old, and that you have to go through the process of creating the old, creating something that you're going to destroy, because it's out of that process of destruction that you're going to find the roots of new ideas and new thoughts. That's the difference between thinking and learning. Learning, somebody tells you something and you hear it, you've got it. That's not thinking, that's learning. And then you add to it. You add and the thing gets bigger and bigger. But that's not thinking. Thinking is to take an assumption, to find the weakness in that assumption, to destroy that assumption, and out of the very destruction, to create the next idea. That's the process of thinking. That's the evolution of ideas. And that says the Reb Notto Hirsch is the essence of God's process and the essence of man's process. Okay. Why is that so, and what is that process? Before we try and understand it, let's look at what leads to it and examples of it. Examples of it. If we take Adam himself, so God puts Adam on the world, it doesn't take 2 minutes and Adam is destroying. And there's terrible destruction. Death, degeneracy, terrible destruction. What is the outcome of that? Adam is punished. What is Adam's punishment? part of his punishment is premature death by 70 years. Those 70 years are the 70 years of King David's life. So God creates King David's life out of the punishment and destruction of Adam. It's not a new thing. David doesn't come from nowhere. The roots of David's existence are nourished by the ashes of Adam's sin. Strange concept, but there we see it. We see the 10 generations from Adam to Noah. If there wouldn't have been 10 generations of decline, would there have been a Noah? There wouldn't have been a need for a Noah, so there wouldn't have been a Noah. If there wasn't a Noah, would there have been the 7 Noahide laws? There wouldn't have been. The 7 Noahide laws are the foundation of civilization. Where do they come from? The necessity to construct them out of the decline of the 10 previous generations. Out of those 10 generations comes a Noah, saves humanity, regenerates humanity with 7 principles of civilization. Then 10 generations of decline until Avram. Would Avram have made such a discovery if God was always assumed to exist? No, the assumption was idolatry. Avram destroys the idolatry assumption, and out of that destruction builds his ideas, builds his thesis of a single and unitary God, and then proves his thesis. That he builds the thesis out of the destruction of the thesis of idolatry. Without the idolatry, there wouldn't have been an Avram. The decline in Egypt that yields a nation that is so degenerate that God, so to say, can hardly tell the difference between them and the Egyptians. And God takes them out and they reach the climax. Within 49 days, they've reached climax. Even less than that, even at the Yamsuf, 7 days, less than 7 days after they've left Egypt, they're already seeing prophecy. And 49 days later, they're saying, Naase v'nishma, and God is saying, who told them the secret? Who gave them this amazing secret that only the angels know about? 49 days after they had reached such levels of decadence. What is this power that we're able to build out of destruction? If you look at the very sentence of the creation of man, not here, we retold the story of the creation of man in the second chapter, and we'll do that part two. But there it says, "Vayitzer Elohim es ha'adam min ha'adama." God created man from earth. Vayehi, and he breathed into him the breath of life. Vayehi ha'adam lenefesh chayo, and that clod of earth was transformed into a living being, a nefesh chayo, with a neshama, with intellect. He could speak. He could communicate. He could think. He had a soul. That man is transformed from a clod of earth into a nefesh chayo. That's the power of man. The power of man is to transform. The power of man is the ability to take something as dead and as sterile as a clod of earth and to become and to transform it into something living. To elevate the mundane into the holy. To elevate the secular into the spiritual. To elevate the material into the spiritual. That's what man can do. But man must also be able to do the converse then. If man can elevate the material into the spiritual, he can certainly destroy the spiritual and create material. He can certainly take the soul out of something. He can certainly destroy something and leave it in ashes. That's something that the human being can do. And that, in fact, is the essence of his bechira. That is the free choice of the human being. The choice of the human being is to do good or to do bad. What does that mean? To destroy or to build. It's not just to do good with his own life. He can destroy other people's lives as well. He can destroy other human beings, he can destroy societies, he can destroy ideas, he can destroy worlds. Whatever he can create, he can also destroy. That's the power that God has given man, because that was God's power. Angels can't do that. Angels can't destroy, angels can't create. It's in that area that we're similar to God and not similar to angels. So it's our power to generate. It's our power to regenerate. The fact that we can take something that we can clean, we can cleanse, that we can purify, that we can refresh, that we can rejuvenate. That's something very special about the human being's capacity in a relatively small time to take something that is spent and to give it life. To take something that has been soiled and to cleanse it completely. Sometimes you can go to bed at night at the end of a terribly hard day or terribly hard week or 2 weeks or 6 weeks, and you cannot imagine when you go to bed how you're going to get up the next morning. And if you have a good night's sleep, even not a long night's sleep, you can wake up quite refreshed. That's the human capacity for regeneration. That there are times when you think it's impossible, and we can turn the corner, we can change. We can turn something around 180 degrees, and very quickly we can do it. That's the human capacity for transformation. That's the human capacity for atonement, to take sin and to transform it into mitzvah, to take a wrong and to transform it into a right. And how do we do that? There are processes for these things. It's not easy, but the process of atonement, the process of transformation, of changing ourselves. If we can change ourselves, we can change anything and anyone. The hardest thing to change is ourselves. And to change ourselves, that we can do with the process of atonement. And we know what the process of atonement is: the recognition that something wrong has been done, the verbalization of it, the actual apology, actually saying to the person to whom you have wronged, to be able to say, I've done this. This is what I did. It's terribly wrong. I should never have done it. I don't know how or why I did, and I'll never do it again. One is able to, with that, to completely cleanse oneself and to transform oneself, if one's able to do that sincerely. And so we've got to understand that kapora, atonement, is not the outcome of man's sin. Atonement is an essential human quality. Without atonement, there is no human being. Without the capacity to transform the negative into the positive, there is no human being. We wouldn't be able to think if there wasn't that. Again, what is thinking? Taking an idea, a false idea, and destroying it, and from its destruction, building a new idea. That's the process of atonement. Taking an action, a false action, a negative action, and from the destruction of that action, building a new and better action. The destruction of the bad is as great as the creation of the good. The destruction of the false is as true as the building of truth. The destruction of a lie is as important as the sustaining of honesty. They're equally important. You cannot have one without the other. What we see here is that the human being is occupied in process, is not occupied only in outcome. If it was only a question of outcome, there would be no need to destroy. You would just get it right the first time. You wouldn't have to go through the process of destruction. And what is the process of destruction? That is the process of refining. An idea comes, and you develop the idea, and you find the fault of the idea. And as a result of that, you're able to see some new angle that you missed in the initial process. And the process is one of growing. In that process, not only is the idea growing, but you're growing. As you're developing the new thing from the old, and you're destroying the old to create the new, and now the new becomes the imperfect, and you find the imperfection in the new, and you destroy the new, and you create something still newer. And this is a process that goes on and on. With that, you grow. Whereas if the answer were given to you at the very end, this is the perfect answer. You don't have to go through the process. I'll save you all the trouble. Here it is. You'll have the answer, but you'll be a pygmy. You will not have gone through the growing process. It doesn't take place. The growing process is through process, not through reaching the outcome. Or not only through reaching the outcome. And so we see that process is godly. Process is not something which is unique to man. Process is something which is unique to God and differentiates God from angel. The angel works instantaneously. The angel works without process. Man works with process. Man works like God. And God works with process. You remember, right in one of the very early shiurim on the creation, we had a view in the Medrash that time existed before the creation. That time was in fact a creation of God, not a creation of man. An unusual view, not held by most authorities. Most people see time as a reality of this world and not as an absolute. But we had a view that time is an absolute. If there's process, there has to be time. Because process means first you do one thing and then you do another thing. If God created one world and then destroyed it, and then created another and then destroyed it, and finally created ours, that means before the creation of this universe, there was sequence because there was process. If there's process, there's got to be time. So we see how far this goes in the thinking process. The Gemara says this is a strange Gemara. Two strategy models on the same line. The one in Sanhedrin, Daf Yud Zayin, says, Ein Moshivin B'Sanhedrin, the only people that are qualified to sit on the Sanhedrin. So you're now talking about where you're looking for the top 70 brains and scholars and saints of Jewish life to put on the Sanhedrin. One of the reasons we don't have a Sanhedrin today is because there aren't 70 that fulfill the qualifications. But one of the qualifications is Mishi Yodal Taheres Asheretz Binatzero. You need a scholar that could prove that a sheretz, that's an example of a sheretz, a snail, is kosher, and he would have to prove from the Torah that it's kosher, not even from rabbinic sources. He would have to be able to prove from the Torah that a snail is kosher. If you cannot do that, you can't put him on the Sanhedrin. What kind of a requirement is that? It doesn't say he must say that the snail is kosher, and it doesn't say he must eat snails. It just says he must be able to prove from the Torah that a snail is kosher. And the Gemara says in Erevin, Talmid Vosiko Yobi Yavne, there was a well-known scholar in Yavne, Shoyo Matiris Asheretz Bekufnu Tamim, who had 150 proofs that snails were kosher. 150, they're not kosher, but he had 150 proofs that they were. So what do you do with those 150 proofs? You've got to find 151st one that destroys the 155th one. That's the process. I'll bring you one proof, I'll bring you a disproof. I'll bring you another one, I'll bring you a disproof. 150 times that comes, and it's the 151st disproof that leaves the halacha where it is. But you've got to go through that process. If you just come along and say, is a snail kosher? Of course it's not kosher. Everybody knows it's treif. That's not the process of thinking. The process of thinking is a snail kosher? Well, let's have a look and see. Let's examine the sources. Maybe it is. Here's a good reason why it should be. What do you say about that? And you start the process. No, it cannot be. And then you come after 150 reasons why a snail should be kosher, the 151st reason why it shouldn't. The process is what's important. Why does he waste time on 150 reasons why a snail is kosher when everybody knows it isn't kosher? What's the time wastage? That's not time wastage. That's the learning process. That's the thinking process. That's the process of going through the way God does, so to say, to take an idea, examine it, and not go to the next step until you've found the flaw in that idea. Because finding the flaw in the wrong is laying the foundation for the right. Finding the flaw in the negative is laying the foundation for the positive, and that's how God built the world. He built one universe and he destroyed it. And he built out of that another one that was better than the first one. But it wasn't right yet. And then another one, and then another one. Until he came to this universe and he looked at this universe with all what the imperfections that we see in it. And God said, this one I like. This is the first one I like. This one I'm going to keep. That was the process. Could God not have got it right the first time? Of course God could have got it right the first time. But he teaches us the process. This is the godly process. The process is not creating it right. The process is not perfecting. The process is not creating perfection. It's evolving perfection. It's a completely different process. And we've discussed before that there are different types of people and there are different types of businesses. There are people who are perfectionists. What does a perfectionist mean? He won't let his work go out until it's perfect. That person, he calls himself a perfectionist. What he really is a balgaiva. He's arrogant. He's not willing to allow himself or his work to become part of the process of perfecting, and his work might not be the final outcome. He wants his to be the final outcome. So he sits on it and sits on it and sits on it until he's got it perfect. And it isn't perfect, of course. And usually by the time he's ready for it to go out, already other people have got things that are just as good or almost as good or twice as good. And he's missed it altogether. There's another process which is one of constant iteration, where you put something out, you get feedback, an idea goes out, the idea is criticized, you modify the idea, you put it out again. It's exactly the same with a product. Put a product out, get feedback, modify it, put another one out. It doesn't have to be right the first time if you understand the principle of kapora. I mentioned to you that this was one of the genius ideas, perhaps one of the first organizations that understood this properly was Toshiba. When they invented the laptop and they realized they weren't going to get it right first time, and if they tried to get it right first time, the Americans would be there first. And so the only way that they could do it was not to get it right first time, but to go through the process, and as long as they knew how to say to their customers, you know, you were right. That one had problems. Send it back. We'll send you a new one without the problems. We're sorry. Kapora. If one understands the capacity to withdraw something, to say I'm sorry, you're more able to put it out there. That doesn't mean we should be willing to put second class material or ideas or actions out. Of course we're constantly going to be doing our best. But we need to know that our best might not be somebody else's best. And that even in our best, an outsider might find a flaw. And that's okay. That's part of the process. Put out your best. And invite the criticism. and be able to say, thank you for the criticism. You're right. It's not perfect. I'm going to make it a little better now. And put it out again. And you'll be criticized once again. The fear of criticism and the fear of rejection holds the whole process back. And the fear of that criticism is part of the arrogance of man. That's not part of the humility of man. The humility of man is the humility that God experiences when he creates a world and then looks at it and says, but this just isn't good enough. Here's the problem. And so he destroys it, and out of the destruction creates another one. And so he goes on until he creates that which he wants and that which he appreciates. So what does God teach us when he consults with the angels? The idea is not that he's asking their permission. He's putting an idea out to the angels. He knows the angels aren't as clever as he is. He created the angels. He knows even if the angels say we don't want man created, he'll still create man. That's not the point. The point is to teach man the process of putting your work out for criticism, of allowing it to be seen and heard by others, even junior to you, because they're outside of you, they're objective. Let them see it, let them hear it, let them pull it to pieces, let them argue with you, as the angels do argue with man. And we'll look at one of those arguments till this evening, where the angels do argue with God and say, we don't think you should create man. And there's a discussion, there's a debate. Of course God's will is going to be the final will, but there's richness in the debate, there's learning in the debate, there's progress in the debate. So God says, what I'm teaching you is not just a matter of courtesy, this is process. Process is debate, discussion, challenge, questioning. Even if you think you know all the answers, put it out there and have it criticized. Have it criticized by junior people if there are no senior people. Have it criticized by inferior people if there are no superior people. But have it criticized by somebody, because that's the process. Not just to make them feel inclusive, but because the outcome is a better outcome. The process actually enriches. To build the good on the destruction of the bad is a far better process than just to build it for the first time and think that you're going to get it right. And so God engages the angels in the process. Let us make man in our image. What do you think about this, angels? And the angels respond. There are various different responses. And the one is, Nasu maloche ashores kisim kisim, the chaburus chaburus. The angels started lobbying and they started forming themselves into political groupings, and they started arguing and they started pressurizing God. There was the one school of thought among the angels that said, yes, create man, and one school of thought that said, don't create man. So there's a debate going on, and God lets this debate happen. Although in his mind he's made a decision, he's going to create man. The debate takes place. And the verse that's quoted is from Tehillim, Chesed ve'emes nifgoshu, tzedek v'sholem noshoku. Kindness and truth met, and righteousness and peace kissed. What was the story? It says the Medrash. Chesed omer, the angels that projected the ideas of kindness, said, Yiborosh u'gomer chasodim. There will be no kindness in the world if there are no humans. Human beings are the vehicle of kindness. And we want to see human beings. We want to see kindness promoted. And for that there should be people. Ve'emes omer al Yiborosh u'kulo shkorim. And truth says, no, don't create man, because man is deceitful. And if we want truth, if we want clarity and truth in the world, don't have human beings. Tzedek omer yiboro, righteousness says, create them. Shu eset tzedakos, who will give charity if there aren't human beings? Who will do righteousness if there aren't human beings? Shalom omer al yiboro dekulik toto, peace. Shalom says, don't create man. If you want shalom in the world, if you want peace in the world, no human beings. You go to a beautiful nature reserve where there are no people and you'll experience tranquility. Go to New York City and you'll see what the opposite of tranquility is. What's the difference? One has human beings, one doesn't. Keep human beings out, say the angels of peace. What did God do? It's two against two. And God doesn't want to intervene and impose his will on the four of them, because that wouldn't be democratic. So he's got a deadlock situation without a constitution. What do you do? It's interesting. Let's see. Maybe there's some ideas here. Very simple. He said, I've got two against two. Not al emes v'ishlichu l'oretz. He took truth and he threw him out. Now he only had one against two. Very simple. Omru malachi ashoyes k'nechadish baruch hu ribayin ha'ilam ma'atam bevazit taksis al tachsich shiach shilcha. What have you done, God? You've taken emes, the quality that most resembles you, and you've thrown that out. And now you've got a majority that man should be created because you threw emes out, and emes is the one quality, truth is the one quality that is most exemplifies who you are. Answers God, Tale emes min ha'oretz. Don't worry about emes. Emes will come up from the earth. Hadov dichtiv, that's what it says in Tehillim, Emes me eretz titzmach, truth will grow out of the earth. And the Ktzos HaChoshen, a famous, very powerful Talmudist, says in his introduction, what this means is God takes out absolute truth. And says if we're going to create man, you can't have absolute truth, because with absolute truth there is no process. With absolute truth there is no thinking. Whether it really applies there, not having gone through the reasoning process. The Talmudic process, the halakhic process, is one of thinking, and it's bringing a proof and it's destroying the proof, and it's proposing an idea and it's rejecting the idea. And out of the rejection, each time, out of finding what's wrong with that idea, you build the next idea. And out of finding the flaw of that idea, you build the next idea. And that's how there's human growth in the process of halakhic reasoning. And so when we look at the Gemara in Sota and we see the enormous degeneracy, the depravity that the world will experience prior to the time of the coming of the Mashiach, and we say, how will the Mashiach come out of that? It's out of the destruction of that degeneracy that the Mashiach is created. Just as so right through history we've seen that out of destruction one is able to take the very act of destruction and create something true and beautiful out of that destruction, so it will be out of the destruction of that depravity that the sanctity of the period of the Mashiach will come. We have to go through that process. We have to go through a depraved existence and be able to find the depravity and see it and look at it and crack it open and destroy it from the inside in order to lay the foundation for an existence that doesn't have that. That's what the Messianic period means. It's actually the destruction of so many things that have become a normal part of our lives that aren't okay. Things that are not moral, things that are not in order, things that are not according to the vision that God has for where the world needs to ultimately come. But in order to get there, we have to go with the process. It's for that reason that there's always been a view of not hurrying the coming of the Mashiach. It's a process. Things have to happen in the right order. Things have to happen. It's not something that suddenly occurs. There's a process that humanity has to go through in order to experience it. There is the story of the Kovnerov, who was in Europe just before the Holocaust. He was the Rav of Kovner, and his daughter was in London and wrote to him to say that she had arranged a passage for him and he could get out and he could come to London in time before the war, which was clearly coming. And he wrote back a letter to her that she showed my father about 20 years ago. She was living in Tel Aviv at the time. She had the letter from the Kovner Rav, and she showed him the letter, which said, I'm too old and I'm not well, so for me to make the journey to London is not possible. But you should know, he said to her, that I know that a terrible destruction is coming and the whole of Eastern European Jewry will be destroyed. I don't know if it's because we are wicked and this is our destruction and our punishment, or because this is the beginning of the germ of something new and great and good, where we are the sacrifice and out of the destruction on the altar comes a new era of something very positive. But he said, you'll know. And you'll know after the destruction. If after the destruction the status of the Jewish people continues to decline, then you will know that we were wicked and this was our punishment. However, if soon after the destruction in Europe there is a reversal in the fate of the Jewish people, and the Jewish people find themselves in a far better situation than ever before, you will know we were saints and we were the ones who made it possible for you. That's the end of his letter. The clarity of thinking, the clarity of understanding that sometimes great things are born out of terrible destruction, that the destruction of that which is flawed in the first place has to take place before the greatness can occur. Does that mean that Eastern Europe was flawed? Sure, there were parts of Eastern Europe, there were parts of Jewry and European Jewry that were flawed. There were parts that were enormously flawed. The birth of Reform Jewry was in Germany. The birth of Reformation, of the birth of major assimilation, was in Germany. The very origins of the secularization of the Jewish people was the point at which the destruction of Europe came, the destruction of all of that Jewry came. So yes, something had to be destroyed. There had to be major change, and sometimes the change is through major upheaval and turmoil to transform that which is negative into creating something which is positive. Of course, that places an enormous burden on the positive. If we are the outcome, we had better be deserving of that outcome and not find ourselves merely becoming the next thing to be destroyed in the process of perfecting. And whether we're the one or the other is our bechira, that's our free choice. Whether we as a generation, whether we as a nation, are merely going to become the sacrifice for the next generation, or we ourselves are going to evolve into that beautiful outcome that God has planned for humanity, that is something that to some degree we have control over through the choices we make, through the decisions we make, and the type of life we as a nation, we as a generation, choose to live. And perhaps it's that sorting out, the turbulence of that sorting out, which is taking place right now. But what's important is that in that process we see the process, that in that process we debate ideas, that we listen to ideas, that we hear ideas, ideas that are different to ours, and we listen to them for their merits and we listen to them for their flaws, and we challenge them and we allow our ideas to be challenged, that we don't wrap ourselves up into the narrowness of other ideas that are similar to our own, never allowing ourselves the benefits of being heard by people who differ from us and hearing people who differ from us, learning from people who are different from us and teaching people who are different from us, in order that from that interaction, if it's done with humility, with the capacity to atone, with the capacity to withdraw, with the capacity to say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, let's try that again. If one's able to do it with that, then out of that humility, out of the destruction of the old, comes the new. Out of the atonement and out of the humiliation of the apology comes the establishment of the glory of the future, of that which is true and that which is bold. Thank you for your attention this evening.